And now your North Carolina Reading Service presents the following program for our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners. It's the Indie Week, the Independent, read by John Federson this week, and the issue dated March the 26th of 2025. All right, let's start over in Durham with the Durham City Council, and they have approved the Pickett Apartments despite environmental concerns. After nearly 3 hours of rigorous discussion on Monday, the City Council approved the 140-unit apartment complex on Pickett Road by a 4-3 vote. That's a 6.212-acre project, and was originally brought before the City Council on February 3rd. At that meeting, residents raised concerns about the environmental impact of the project on bird habitats and flooding into nearby Durham Academy and Sandy Creek Trail, as well as transit accessibility, traffic overflow, and student safety. The case came back to City Hall on Monday. Council Member Javier Caballero recommended the case be continued until a later date to give neighbors and representatives from Durham Academy the opportunity to collaborate with the developer to address some of the concerns. Two council members also were missing from that discussion, Deidreana Freeman and Chelsea Cook. Both had excused absences from the February meeting. Well, the case did come back to City Hall on Monday, where the developer offered additional commitments to try and meet the requests of residents, including adding elevators to the apartment design, making a $300,000 contribution to the Durham Parks Foundation, and installing bird-friendly window treatments. Still, many residents upheld their original opposition to that project, carrying over concerns from the previous meeting. William Schlesinger, former dean of Nicholas School of the Environment at Duke University and past president of the Ecological Society of America, said the case was, quote, far from a not-in-my-backyard NIMBY issue. He echoed a position held by many folks in the room. The biodiversity that Sandy Creek Park attracts is under threat by surrounding developments like Pickett Apartments due to flooding, runoff, and pollution. Schlesinger said he and his wife have tracked over 100 species of birds in the park over the last decade, as well as numerous other creatures who call Sandy Creek home. And he said this rich biodiversity gives a richness of experience for visitors from all parts of Durham and stems from the wonderful natural habitat there in Sandy Creek Park. Jesse Burkhead, a member of the Feminist Bird Club in Durham and the New Hope Bird Alliance, who works in land conservation, urged City Council to direct more infill development throughout Durham's urban areas, including her own neighborhood, instead of near environmentally sensitive areas. And she said, many of us don't live near the park, and we would welcome development of affordable housing in our own neighborhoods and communities. We know that affordable housing is critical to Durham. Walking the Sandy Creek Trail, which is designated as a handicap-accessible park, has become increasingly more hazardous, said Jody Barlett, a longtime resident of the neighborhood, who spoke at the February public hearing. The sides of the creek bed are eroding, causing trees to uproot and fall into and around the trail. Water from the creek has also started leaking into the trail. Bartlett and others are worried that what's left of the trail and the park will not survive the runoff caused by construction at Pickett Apartments and the nearby Vintage Durham Apartments. Both those projects will also contribute to increased traffic and congestion on the road. But according to the city's traffic study, the road is underutilized and could handle an uptick in volume outside the peak hours during school drop-off and pickup. Despite pushback from residents and the Planning Commission, which voted to deny the project 8-2, Council voted 4-3 to approve. Council members who voted yes, Caballero, Carl Rist, Mark Anthony Middleton and Mayor Leonardo Williams noted the project encourages density rather than sprawl, is close to parks, and incorporates strong proffers from the developer in response to community requests. Councilmember Nate Baker, although he ultimately voted against the project, cited some of the same qualities in his remarks. He said that blending dense urban development with the natural world should be the ideal design for every Durham resident. Sarah Young, planning director with City of Durham, said that sites like Pickett Apartments were identified during the development of the comprehensive plan specifically because of their proximity to open space. Baker said, "My hope is that we would move our city toward one where we increase the percentage of our residents who are within a 5-minute walk to parks. I believe that would be a good metric of success." Ultimately, it wasn't enough for 3 council members, Baker, Cook, and Freeman, who voted against the project. While it was better than urban sprawl developments that come before city council, Baker says, it lacks infrastructure like sidewalks and connectivity to public transit needed for high-density development, making it entirely car-dependent. He told the Indy, "Even just waiting till the UDO rewrite is finalized early next year, we'd have critical design and sustainability standards in place. I'm willing to entertain greater intensities, but with greater intensities, we need to have higher expectations." Other councillors who voted no said they're still uncertain about traffic safety and the environmental impact of the project on Sandy Creek Trail. Cook said while she agrees with the council's charge to develop within the urban growth boundary, not every parcel of land with the UBG should be developed, or there will be little green space left for residents to enjoy. Even the parks and open spaces that exist, Cook says, are not accessible to many residents because of the lack of connectivity through public transit. Cook says there is a trade-off here. We have a high vacancy rate already for apartments in Durham. We say that the things will come, the safety and connectivity will follow, but we haven't really seen that. As with many rezoning cases, the City Council is weighing a limited set of options for how to proceed. The Pickett Apartments site is already zoned for residential, meaning the developer can build up to single-family homes on the site by right without need for approval from City Council. But to upzone the property and include higher density on the same plot of land, the developer needs sign-off from council. This is where residents in the City Council can step in to make additional requests called proffers, things like building parks on the site, making donations to the local school system, or setting aside units designated for affordable housing as a way for the developer to sweeten the deal for a community. During the meeting, Caballero laid out these circumstances that she and her colleagues are weighing each time a case like Pickett Apartments comes before them. If they chose not to approve the rezoning, the 12 hypothetical homes built on the site would likely be large and in the range of $700,000 to $1 million and would not have to include any of the proffers made by the developer. Caballero said, "We always collectively have to think about the vision we've set aside, and right now this council and the 2 councils before, with that comp plan that we've adopted, we passed an urban growth boundary." Caballero and Middleton said the council has prioritized keeping fidelity with the urban growth boundary. That is a line beyond which the city council has said it would prohibit future development to prioritize density and infill closer to the city center. At the February meeting where Pickett Apartments was first presented, the city council voted down a zoning case near Mount Moriah Road because it violated the limits of the UBG. But to continue upholding that boundary means more of Durham's urban land will get upzoned, Caballero said, in order to protect farmland and watersheds throughout the county. Durham needs to increase its density to avoid urban sprawl, but more and more of the green space available to residents is being threatened in the process, and rarely is a site ever turned back into woodlands or green space after it's been developed. City and county leadership has to strike a difficult balance between growth and preservation. For Councilmember Carol Rist, the community should not have to choose between affordable, dense projects and nature. Carol Rist said, "There's an opportunity for abundance here that we've all just got to embrace." He referenced a forthcoming book, Abundance, in which authors Ezra Klein and Derek Thompson make a case that some governments, particularly liberal-leaning ones, have failed to keep up with building infrastructure and providing basic services that their constituents need to thrive. Rist said that Pickett Apartments is an example of striking a balance between meeting our goals as a community of providing affordable housing and supplying residents with accessibility to green space. He said, "I think we can have that abundance and meet the multiple goals we're addressing here as a city for affordable housing and parks. We have to aspire to that, or otherwise we're going to get crushed in this old politics of housing versus environment." Now, this article next looks like a sort of a backgrounder for us. It's only two pages long, and it's about zero-based budgeting. That's a fresh start for Durham's budget in this particular case. And the article goes on, "Government budgets are a lot like closets. If you don't clean them out occasionally, you get up hoarding stuff you don't need while struggling to find the things that matter. For years, local governments have relied on the add a little here, trim a little there budgeting method. But what if we did it differently?" Enter zero-based budgeting, ZBB. That's the Marie Kondo of government finance. Instead of just adjusting last year's numbers, ZBB forces every department to start from scratch and justify every expense. If it doesn't serve the community effectively, does it really spark joy? No, then maybe it's time to let it go. Unlike traditional budgeting, which simply tweaks last year's number, ZBB starts every budget cycle from scratch. Every department and office must justify all expenses, ensuring that spending aligns with our community's most pressing needs, rather than just rolling over outdated spending. Why does this matter? It eliminates waste, for one. We don't just rubber stamp old allocations. We review programs, and if they aren't effective, we fix them or reallocate the funds. It boosts efficiency. It encourages all departments and offices to think outside the box and make wise spending decisions instead of relying on automatic funding increases. It increases transparency. Residents can see precisely how their tax dollars are spent, making our government more accountable. Why now? Because chaos at the national level means we need stability here at home. Look, if there's one thing we can count on, is that we can't count on the federal government to make smart financial decisions. Between the revolving door of White House economic policies, or lack thereof, and the General Circus Act happening in Washington, the best thing we can do is make Durham's budget as airtight as possible. We don't have the luxury of just hoping for a revenue windfall. We need to plan ahead, and ZBB is how we do it. Several local governments have used ZBB with success, yielding significant savings. Los Altos, California, adopted ZBB and earned multiple awards for excellence in budgeting. This allowed resources to be shifted to where they were most needed. Georgia was the first state to implement ZBB and improve resource allocation and government efficiency. Houston, Texas, used it to prioritize vital services and eliminate unnecessary spending, making the city's budget more sustainable. Why this matters for Durham. This year, I'm prioritizing ZBB to ensure we are strategically prepared for future budget cycles, especially as we face several fiscal challenges. Here's one. Declining sales tax revenue. Our budget department has reported Durham County has seen a nearly 10% decrease in sales tax revenue. Limitations on progressive property taxation. State law restricts our ability to implement progressive property tax rates, limiting our flexibility in revenue generation and creating inequitable tax burdens on our most vulnerable residents. Uncertain future revenues. Given these constraints, we can't rely on high revenue growth we have experienced in the past few budgets. Let's embrace this opportunity to rethink our budgeting process, eliminate redundancies, and invest wisely in Durham's future. By evaluating every expense now through ZBB, we can ensure that our spending decisions are based on essential community needs rather than outdated or inefficient patterns. If we get this right, we'll be prepared for future tax revaluations and beyond. If we don't, well, we'll be stuck playing financial whack-a-mole while Washington continues setting money on fire, while their billionaire friends get tax cuts. Bottom line, if we don't clean out and reorganize the budget closet now, we're going to regret it later. Let's make every dollar count. I neglected to read the author of the article I just read about zero budget balancing, zero bottom line. And that is Nida Alam, who is the chair of the Durham County Board of Commissioners. Next, another short article from Durham. What will it take for Durham to eliminate traffic deaths? For residents traveling by foot, bike, scooter, wheelchair, or car, traveling on Durham's streets can be a perilous pursuit. But at a city council work session last Thursday, Lauren Grove, the city's Vision Zero coordinator, presented her recommendations for a Vision Zero action plan, a proposal for how the city would confront Durham's growing traffic violence issue head-on. From 2019 to 2023, Durham residents suffered 278 serious injuries, up from 177 the previous 5 years, and 121 fatalities in that same time frame, up from 97. Black and Hispanic residents are at higher risk, making up 51% of the population combined, but 68% of fatalities. The city first adopted Vision Zero, a multinational movement to reduce traffic deaths and serious injuries, in 2017. Vision Zero is akin to the Paris Climate Accords. Communities across the world coalesce around a set of guidelines and principles to reduce traffic violence and adopt Vision Zero on their own timeline. Last year, Durham City Council adopted a new resolution to reinforce its commitment to Vision Zero by including a target date, reduce deaths and serious injuries by 50% in 2035, and eliminate them by 2045. Grove recommended six main policies to help the city meet its goal. Update the city's land use code. Create a street design manual. Conduct more routine safety assessments. Improve streets more rapidly. Manage safe speeds. And share traffic safety insights. Some of these policies are already in motion. Durham's planning department has its hands full rewriting the joint city-county unified development ordinance, the rules that govern development. Last fall, the City Council also adopted the NACTO guidelines, a set of national design standards for transportation networks. The standards brought forth by the Vision Zero Action Plan will be baked in to those fund frameworks to make policies consistent across internal city and county departments, as well as external rules that govern private development. Even with these new standards, for the action plan to be successful, Grove said, the city will need to improve how it tracks and leverages information on crashes and fatalities to measure the effectiveness of different policy interventions and make recommendations that can be acted on swiftly and save lives. Councilmember Nate Baker, who encouraged City Council to adopt the NACTO standards, called traffic violence, quote, a pandemic that not only doesn't go away, it gets worse every single year, during his presentation. 74% of incidents that lead to death or injury happen on streets that make up the city's high injury network, which accounts for just 10% of Durham streets, and just 9% of streets in Durham have more than two lanes, but they account for 59% of fatal crashes. Without changes to the built environment, speeding and reckless driving are much harder to curb. Grove said, this is why we see so many of the same streets appearing in fatal and serious injury crashes over and over. These aren't just random incidents, they're patterns. The Vision Zero team plans to create a public-facing data dashboard for residents to monitor the program's progress and input incidents themselves. Grove said they also plan to present crash data and other important metrics during regular updates with the City Council. Advocates like John Talmadge, executive director at Bike Durham, who spoke during public comment, have been, quote, frustrated with the show pace of change on Durham streets. Talmadge said at the World Day of Remembrance in November of 2022, advocates called on City Council and staff to do two things, hire a Vision Zero coordinator and create a Vision Zero action plan. A year later, the city hired Grove to lead its Vision Zero vision. Talmadge says, I believe in the theory of change, that to be able to move more quickly on these changes, you need champions on staff, champions on the elected board, and champions on the outside. I think we're at a good time for that. At a previous work session in March the 6th, Councilmember Carl Rist suggested that reaching the city's Vision Zero goals would be nearly impossible without addressing main one-way streets across downtown Durham and beyond. That's Roxborough and Mangum and Duke and Gregson. Transportation Director Sean Egan responded by saying, quote, there's a definition of doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. I think it's difficult to expect a different result unless we make really significant changes to these roadways. Newly minted City Manager Bo Ferguson said it wasn't clear yet that the two-way conversions are the answer. He said, let's let the data lead us, and certainly we'll be transparent with what our studies find. The Vision Zero Action Plan may have gotten a ringing endorsement from the City Council, but in the race for City Council budget priorities, two-way conversions ranked slightly below the middle of the pack. The project costs are estimated around $5.5 million, and Duke and Gregson Avenues are managed by the state, not the city. Council may have more of a spiritual appetite than a financial one for dealing with the two major downtown thoroughfares, even if they are in the high-injury network. The City Transport Department will have to work with its partners at NCDOT, who own and manage a majority of the major roads in Durham's network, to come up with solutions. The two departments have not always seen eye to eye on how to approach updating state-owned roadways. In the past few years, disagreements have led to project delays, causing some concerns about whether reaching Vision Zero is possible without a unified vision. Chris Perlstein, a bike advocate who spoke at the March 20th work session, quote, "If we're not going to do these corridors now, when in the next 20 years are we going to do that, if we're serious about meeting our Vision Zero goals?" Roxborough and Mangum are especially infamous thanks to Perlstein, who created the Reckless Roxborough Twitter account to track speeding in front of his home on Roxborough Street using cameras and software he developed. He says, despite the speeding issues that Roxborough continues to suffer from, he isn't tied to the idea of changing the street to two-way, but is instead focused on supporting the best solution to get projects done quickly so that more residents can experience the benefits of a pedestrian-friendly transportation network. He says, if you can push the needle on infrastructure, you're going to start having people experience these environments that are much more pleasant for them to be in. And I think that's going to drive more buy-in in the future, which then hopefully will get more infrastructure change. I think that one begets the other. Now, folks, here is a humongous article in Indy Week. On paper, I'm looking at like 10 pages of dense prose. If I started to read that now, I wouldn't complete it by the end of the broadcast. I've decided that I will give you an alert that it exists. It just showed up in the Indy Week issue, this issue, and it concerns the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, that's called FERC, FERC. FERC is alleging that the Durham-based American Efficient operated a fraudulent energy efficiency scheme. And I'm going to read the first few paragraphs of this and get your feel for it. Again, I'll remind you again that all these articles appear for free in the Indy Week website, indyweek.com. And you can read it or have your machine read it to you if you want to hear details. And there are plenty of details. They include graphs and charts of a few of them. But here's the beginning of this. Pardon me. At Duke University, an elite school teeming with stars, Ben Abrams shone among the brightest. Media reports from his undergrad years, 2003-07, portray a young man whose vigor was rivaled only by his ambition. Senior class president of the engineering school, winner of two prestigious science awards, and after graduation, a member of the university board of trustees. The grandson of a civil rights advocate and former Brandeis University president, Abram grew up in Chapel Hill. As a college student, he volunteered in Uganda as part of Engineers Without Borders, which improved drinking water wells in rural villages. In Durham, he mentored an underprivileged child. He also spent time in the rarefied air of privileged. He hobnobbed with distinguished guests at a weekly speaker series held in his apartment and paid for by Duke University. Among them were David Folkenflik, a correspondent for National Public Radio, and Sonal Shah, vice president of Goldman Sachs. After graduation, He began working in the field of clean energy and formed several companies, headquarters in Durham. He told Duke Today in 2023, quote, "It's a great feeling to work in partnership with my team and other professionals to wrestle with this complex, important issue and come up with unique and effective business models that can contribute to the energy transition." Those business models were indeed unique, according to federal investigators, but not effective. After a 3.5-year probe by the agency, FERC investigators in December filed an order to show cause and notice of a proposed penalty against Abrams companies. Those are American Efficient, Modern Energy, and several affiliates. In a 178-page document, FERC alleged the companies fraudulently operated a vast and lucrative energy efficiency scheme that cost ratepayers hundreds of millions of dollars and saved no energy at all. The companies face up to $720 million in civil penalties, which is the largest fine in the history of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. That amount equals 80% of all FERC civil penalties since that commission began assessing them 18 years ago. They could also be required to return $250 million in what investigators call, quote, unjust profits to the energy grid operators. That includes a $26 million performance bonus for purportedly saving energy during Winter Storm Elliott in 2022. According to the investigation, quote, what American Efficient passes off as energy efficiency is really just market research. For a decade, they have helped to deliver energy savings for wholesale energy markets by working with manufacturers, distributors, and retailers to adopt energy-efficient products, says a company spokesperson for Inside Climate News. FERC's Office of Enforcement, quote, unfairly targeted our company for operating a business in a manner similar to many other market participants and consistent with the rules as understood and interpreted by operators of the electric grid. Quote, for years our company has complied beyond required standards to operate with transparency within these markets. And FERC's Office of Enforcement should not be allowed to change the rules after the fact and then trying to penalize us years later. All right, well, that's just page one of 9 pages. Again, I have too many articles to get to. I apologize. But IndyWeek.com can get that, call that up, and you can peruse it as you will. It's a long, detailed article about the ins and outs and the regulatory elements to these charges. And they are going to be expensive charges once it comes, if it ever does, to trial. All right, now we'll move on to something different. And where will I head? I'll head to two different library systems first, and replacements and openings. Carrboro, and I'll just capsule this. Carrboro's Drakeford Library Complex is officially open on 203 South Greensboro Street. Town manager Patrice Tony said this property used to be a parking lot. Today, it's the largest public facility in the history of Carrboro. The window-filled 52,000-square-foot complex includes, yes, the southern branch of the Orange County Library, but its three stories are also stuffed with classrooms, meeting rooms, a teen center, career center, radio station, public art, a performance space, a Durham Tech Community College nursing aid lab, and more. Advocates have pushed for the concept of a Carrboro library for decades, but it didn't get off the ground until 2016 when the town and county agreed on a possible location. a wonderfully optimistic timeline hoped for ribbon cutting in March of 2019. But it didn't receive funding until 2022, when the town and county agreed to split the $42 million bill, kicking in roughly equal amounts to build Carrboro's first freestanding public library on an entire downtown block. The balance of that article has comments from the various attendees for the ribbon cutting. Over in the capital city, Wake County will replace Southgate Library with a bigger standalone branch in southeast Raleigh, said the Board of Commissioners. One of the smallest libraries in the system, Southgate is currently located in a Food Lion shopping center off Rock Quarry Road. For years, patrons have complained about cramped space and limited parking. Now the county plans to replace it with a 12,000-square-foot freestanding building in that same neighborhood. Commissioner Tara Waters, whose district includes Southgate, said during the work session the community she represents includes many young people enrolled in Title I public schools who deserve access to a high-quality public library. And that article continues with the plan. The county now expects the new and improved Southgate to open its doors sometime in 2031. There is a 2024 bond issue to pay for, at least to pay for the majority of that. Okay, that's two libraries for you. Again in Raleigh, many of us over the decades really remember the Irregardless restaurant. The former owners of that iconic West Morgan Street restaurant, Irregardless Cafe, are pursuing a new venture. They have a community garden in southwest Raleigh, and they want to convert that to an affordable, multi-generational housing development connected to that garden. The Gordons, Arthur and Anya Gordon, own about 2.5 acres, located across the street from Athens Drive Magnet High School. Some of us remember that there's also a public library branch currently right in that high school. It's currently home, though, to their well-fed community garden. There, they work with a local farmer to grow vegetables, fruits, and herbs, raise chickens, and keep bees. They bought the land at a foreclosure sale in 2012. Intended to grow fresh produce for Irregardless, and did so for years. Since selling the restaurant in 2020, they've been thinking about other purposes the garden property could serve. They envision a 3-story apartment building with older residents living on the first floor, families on the second, and a dormitory style or co-housing on the third. A street-level bodega could sell pre-made meals and fresh produce to neighbors and nearby high schoolers. Residents would be responsible for cultivating the garden, which would continue to exist on a similar footprint. Arthur Gordon says the idea is, the two big issues that seem to be hurting our culture right now are affordable housing and mental health. What I'm pushing for is that the people who end up living on the property have to do something with the garden. They can water the flowers, they can turn the compost. In return, they get a reduced rent. Standing between the Gordons and their dream of communal urban living and agriculture is Raleigh's Unified Development Ordinance, which currently permits only low-scale development of houses or duplexes on their property. The Gordons are petitioning the Raleigh Planning Commission to rezone the land to allow for residential mixed-use development, which would enable them to build a 3-story apartment building with 67 units and retail space on the ground floor. At the Planning Commission's March 11 meeting, Arthur invoked his track record of bringing out-of-the-box ideas like Irregardless to life in Raleigh. Nothing else like this proposal exists, he acknowledged, but there were no non-smoking vegetarian restaurants 50 years ago as well, and today it's considered part of the establishment. The commissioners, along with a few neighbors who spoke in opposition to the request, seemed most concerned about the wide range of retail uses permitted by residential mixed-use zoning. Quote, this land could be sold to a developer and we could wind up with a vape shop or a convenience store, said one neighbor, suggesting the land should be used as the new location of that community library instead. Some neighbors also expressed worries about stormwater implications of redeveloping, since the neighborhood's stormwater system is already at capacity. But Arthur says the development he's proposing would capture stormwater rather than exacerbating runoff. There's going to continue to be a farm on the property, so we want the water, he said. We don't want to make it impervious and have it run off. We want to put it in retaining ponds. Well, the Planning Commission seemed open to the idea, but asked Arthur to come back on April 8th with more conditions attached to the rezoning request, addressing things like height, noise, and lighting restrictions, and prohibitions on certain commercial uses. If the proposal receives approval from Planning Commission and then the City Council, Arthur says their next step would be to sell the property to a non-profit developer who agrees to develop according to their specifications. He and Anya are still looking for the right partner. All right, and we'll move back over to Chapel Hill and the public school teachers there in Chapel Hill Carrboro City Schools, CHC. Last week, Indy reported, despite rumors of mass layoffs, Chapel Hill Carrboro is not currently laying off teachers, and the changes are in staffing are part of a routine allotment process that plays out differently this year because the district has changed its allotment formula in response to declining enrollment. As a result, 31 staffers have been left in a very scary vocational purgatory through the spring. A number of teachers, through an anonymously penned open letter, say some educators have already been notified their jobs won't exist after school gets out for the summer. A letter currently making the round on Facebook groups and provided to the Indy by a teacher who signed on says, although the district claims no teachers have been, quote, laid off, some have received letters stating they would not be offered a contract for employment for the 25-6 school year due to a district-wide reduction in positions. Indy viewed a notice to a teacher signed by Superintendent Nia Hamlet that informs the teacher they will not be offered a contract for next year. It did not leave much room for the possibility of future employment in the district. That language doesn't exactly line up with the message Hamlet sent to the district last week, in which she said those staffers were in a unique circumstance that, quote, could include, but is not necessarily limited to, their positions transferring to another school, their position is not yet available because of enrollment or course registration, but this could change, or another situation that's unique to their position or their school. Unquote. The superintendent did, though, say, we cannot make guarantees at this time about finding other positions for the affected staff. The district says 17 of the 31 teachers have already been reassigned to other roles in the district, leaving as many as 14 without contracts, depending on how many can be placed in other schools. The district has not yet said how many teachers received the same notice from Hamlet that they would not be offered a contract or how closely potential reassignments may align with their previous roles. The teachers argue, quote, while the promise of a job somewhere may seem reassuring, it disregards the years that teachers have spent building meaningful ties within their current school communities, and that the district has, quote, downplayed the real impact of recent staffing decisions, creating confusion and frustration among teachers, families, and the broader community. The reality is that educators are being removed from their current positions, which will inevitably lead to the elimination of certain programs in the 25-6 of 26, 7 school years. CHCCS spokesperson Andy Jenks declined to comment on that open letter, saying it would be, quote, inappropriate to comment on any individual's specific situation. Continuing, we're all doing all we can to place people in additional positions or work creatively in such a way as time goes on, meaning things can change in the spring and summer as master schedules are put together to do what's best for all staff, students, and families. The dollars follow the student has become an oft-repeated phrase in North Carolina education circles lately, as enrollment has dropped in most of the state's public school districts, which get funding from a mix of federal, state, and local sources. While Chapel Hill Carrboro still has one of the highest per pupil expenditures, thanks in part to a special district education tax, the district has lost about 1,000 students, or 7%, over the past 5 years. In implementing a reduction in force, a RIF plan, last year, officials said the district has missed out on $8 million in annual funding due to that lower enrollment. That RIF was focused on cuts to the central office before impacting any personnel in a student-facing role. Last week's changes, hitting mostly teachers, came as the district adjusted for a higher average class size of about 21 students for one teacher, which is a higher number of students than in past years. No Triangle School District is having happy meetings right now. Durham Public Schools is still trying to find ways to fill a $7 million shortfall this year. And Indy recently reported that Wake County Public Schools, which has not suffered from an enrollment drop, is looking at tough choices amid $19 million in cuts needed across the district to close the gap between $60 million increase the district says it needs and the $40 million increase it hopes to receive from the county. Chapel Hill Carrboro Board will likely discuss personnel in its closed session today's meeting. And if Facebook posts and online petitions are any indication, parents and teachers are likely to exercise their First Amendment rights during what may be a longer than average public comment period. All right, I've held over this article, which is fairly lengthy. I don't know how much of it I'll read, but I'll get it started. It's about vultures. Vultures over in Hillsboro, North Carolina. The birds arrive early in the morning and leave before dark. Sometimes there are dozens, sometimes as many as 100. They gather on the lawn, the roof, the trees, and on fencing. They're quiet, sociable creatures. When the sun shines, they lift up their wings to bask in its warmth. Ken and Linda Ostrand love the birds that visit their backyard each day, but these birds are black vultures. And not everyone in their historic Hillsboro neighborhood shares their fondness for the feathered guests. The debate over what to do about them is civil, but it has been going on for a long time, and now town leaders are getting involved. The Ostrands say the vultures came with their house. The previous owner tried unsuccessfully to run them off, but they always return, drawn, think the Ostrands, by the large cleared yard on a southern-facing slope. Surrounded by tall trees and buildings, it's a perfect place for the raptors to lounge in the sun. Shortly after they bought their house in 2017, the Ostrands installed fencing around their yard and in the process offered the local vultures the first of many free meals. Linda recalled, one of the workmen found a dead deer in the back and said, "What do you want me to do with it?" We weren't quite sure what to do with it, so they moved the carcass to where the vultures could get it. And it was gone in a day. It was amazing how thorough they are. After that, Ken said, they began offering the vultures meat scraps and leftovers from time to time and put out water for them regularly. Their neighbors, Michael Beanland and his wife, didn't notice any vultures when they bought their house in 2020. But not long after, they were surprised at how many flocked to the yard next door. and how often. Beanland did not respond to the request for comment from the Assembly. The Assembly is the journal that, from which the Indy gets some of its articles. But he recently told the Hillsborough Board of Commissioners that the Ostrans assured him the birds were migratory and would soon move on. Instead, he said, a pattern developed that has persisted for nearly 5 years. While some of the vultures migrate as the seasons change, many stay local. They regularly spill over into Beanland's yard, where they have damaged roof shingles with their talons and coated his sidewalk with thick layers of excrement. He said he and his wife have found leftovers from meals that the Ostrans put out for the vultures, things we don't want our dog and our children coming in contact with, like meat trays from the supermarket or bones from chicken and steak. The situation reached what he called a tipping point in 2022 when he found several dead vultures in his yard that he believes died from bird flu. Beanland estimates he's contacted the Ostrans 10 to 15 times over the past few years, either in person or via email, asking them to stop feeding the birds, and for a while they would. Once when the Ostrans went on vacation for 2 weeks, he said the birds left entirely. But each time they returned, Ken and Linda offered them snacks. Beanland told town commissioners he sent his most recent mail to the Ostrans in December, once again asking them to stop. In response to this latest round of complaints, Ken said they've cut back on feeding the vultures since the holidays, aside from two of the birds. Ken says, one is Chester. If you're a Gunsmoke fan, you'll know Chester has a bad leg, and in fact he can't move it very well, but he can fly. The other one is Morticia. Morticia is unable to fly because of a bad wing, but they both recognize us come around to try to get fed. Chester is shyer, said Ken, and often flees when they toss food at him. Morticia, on the other hand, will get fairly close, allowing them to throw her scraps directly. Other than the two with obvious physical limitations, the Ostrans say they ignore the birds, but they show up anyway. Linda, who ran a wildlife rehab center on the outskirts of Hillsborough for 7 years, believes vultures are widely misunderstood. They're nature's garbage cleaners, she said. I can understand a lot of people don't want them on their house because they're not the most beautiful floaty little bird, but they do such a good job. They play an important role in the ecosystem as scavengers, scouring the landscape for roadkill and other carrion. Their powerful stomach acid can neutralize botulism, anthrax, rabies, and other pathogens, and there can be severe consequences if they disappear. After widespread use of a veterinary drug for cows accidentally killed off nearly 15 million vultures in India in the 1990s. Infections from bacterial diseases led to the deaths of nearly 500,000 humans over a five-year period, according to a study published in the American Economic Association Journal last year. Linda said, very few people are fans of vultures, but they wouldn't like their life and their world if we didn't have them. They're here for a reason. Mother Nature makes very few mistakes. Vultures are highly intelligent, and despite their rancid diet, they don't pose much health risk to humans, said Colleen Hartman, curator of birds at the Carolina Raptor Center near Charlotte. Still, their excrement is corrosive, thanks to that stomach acid, and they have a habit of projectile vomiting when alarmed. Most people prefer to appreciate them from a distance. Beanland told commissioners he's tried all he can to resolve the situation, and in January, he petitioned the town of Hillsborough for some kind of official intervention. Board members agreed it might be time to take action, noting at their January 13th meeting that this issue has come up repeatedly, and they've heard from multiple other neighbors voicing their displeasure. The emails that we've gotten show a lot of the issues we have trying to enforce anything. Megan Darab said, something on the books that says don't feed the animals may have a little more weight behind it. Most people wouldn't go out of their way to cater to carrion eaters, but Fallon Owens, a wildlife extension biologist with North Carolina Wildlife Resource, says all kinds of people like to field wildlife, feed. Some are hurlers. What did I say? Some are hunters. Some are bird watchers, and some hope to catch glimpses of raccoons, possums, and deer. It's definitely popular, she said, but not mainstream. Wildlife officials do discourage what they call supplemental feeding, but there's no statewide rule against it. Regulation falls to towns, counties, or homeowner associations. Increasingly, towns and counties across the state are trying to dissuade well-meaning residents from initiating feeding routines that can trigger unintended consequences. Carborough, for example, banned deer feeding within the town limits in 2011 due to concerns about overpopulation and disease. Ocean Isle Beach banned wildlife feeding in 2023. Curry Beach town leaders in 24 specifically targeted the practice of feeding gulls at the shore and nearby dunes. Most of those rules include exceptions for backyard bird feeders, but the mountains where black bears frequently roam, the stakes are higher. Elected officials in Buncombe County and in Asheville voted in 2023 to approve updated ordinances that require residents to remove bird feeders and similar food sources if bears or other wildlife start to frequent them. Violations of that county ordinance can result in fines up to about $500. Owens and other wildlife experts recognize it can be difficult to convince people that feeding wildlife usually does more harm than good. Well, folks, I've left a lot on your plate, and I'm going home for lunch right now, right after that article. Thank you very much for listening to Indie Week this week. John Feddersen from the North Carolina Reading Service, reminding you that this issue, like everyone, exists as a podcast and is found on the North Carolina Reading Archives and before next week and the next issue. So thanks very much for listening to us, and we will be back with the next weekly issue next week of Indie Week. Thanks. Bye-bye.